Welcome to this edition of the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined by Matt Oper. How's it going today, Matt?
It is going fantastic. I work retail, so you can imagine I've had a fun week. And that is entirely sarcastic.
You mean Black Friday isn't fun for people who work in retail?
Kind of sucks.
Speaking of kind of sucks, let's jump right into football. The Bearcats play their final football game of the season last Friday. They lose to Tulsa in overtime by the score 40-37. This game, a reversal of a lot of what we've seen lately. Cincinnati just jumped on Tulsa right away. Caught Tulsa pretty much by surprise, especially with the deep ball to the young receivers. But then everything goes to hell the second half. The Bearcats blow a big lead and eventually lose like a very tough game in overtime. So, Swick, what were your thoughts on this game first before we go on to bigger picture thoughts for the season?
You know, Wilt Chamberlain famously said that everybody has a game where they double their average once a year. Like, he said that in reference to his 100-point game way back in 1962. He's like, you got to remember that year I averaged 50. So that 100-point game was just a double of my average. Everybody has a double of their average at some point this year. This game was the double of UC's offensive average for the year, and they still lost because they suck at football.
Just offensively, it was their best game of the season by far.
By miles and miles, it was their best performance. It's like that's one, and there's not even a 1A or a 1B. You, like, skip to four before you get to the next one. Like, it's just, that's how bad the offense has been this year. And they weren't, you know, early in the first half, that was the best they played at any point in the last year, for sure. But they couldn't maintain it, because they haven't really played at that level at all this year.
You mentioned it a bit ago, but a lot of run for the young receivers. Thomas Geddes had over 100 yards, had all of his catches were long bombs. Jaron Rollins had a touchdown, a 70-yard touchdown catch. Like, seeing those two guys get involved did give some hope to the future. At the same time, like, we haven't seen Hayden Moore throw the deep ball that consistently or that well since Memphis. And then by the second half, things did fall apart, and they weren't able to hit on those home runs anymore.
Well, yeah, you're asking a fundamentally inconsistent quarterback to deliver deep down the field with consistency. That seemed to be what the game plan was. You know, he got a couple lucky shots in there, but that's not what he's good at. Frankly, he's not good at much. We've hashed this point out again and again and again. I just don't think he's that good. I don't think he should be the starting quarterback next year. I think they should just move on. And with the new coaching staff, that's probably the most likely course of action.
That's something we hadn't addressed since we haven't been able to get our schedules aligned for the podcast. Is Moore didn't end up starting again after they started Gunnar Keel the last couple of games when we did our last podcast. And I think mixed results overall for Hayden Moore. Kind of a downer season where he didn't really build on his success from last year. He did end with the game, like, solid enough that you could, like, look and say, maybe there's something there for next year. But I don't know, it's just, like, hard to take away a ton from a game where both offenses just went, like, batshit crazy.
That's true. I mean, I think the larger point with Hayden Moore, though, is this isn't – he's been around a while. He's played a lot of football. We kind of know what he is, and what he is isn't quite good enough. He had a good game, but, you know, he did little to assuage my doubts that have lingered ever since the BYU game, where he literally imploded in on himself.
He did catch a touchdown pass on, like, the best drawn-up play of the entire season. Like, that play was pretty great. They should have busted it out during the Houston game.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the best trick play since the Win to Kelsey jump pass.
Like, a lot of the same problems that have flawed UC all season long, like, reared their head in the finale. 4-16 on third down, flip it over to the other side. Tulsa gets over 600 yards of offense. James Flanders has an incredible game, like 40 carries for nearly 200 yards, scored a game-winning touchdown. Dane Evans looked all right, I guess. But he still like was able to get some big plays against the UC defense, especially to Lucas, who had a really nice game.
Yeah, I mean, Tulsa, this isn't really a surprise if you watched any of Tulsa this year. They're a very talented, very deep, very well-conceived offense. They're going to put up yards on points on basically whoever they're playing. And that's with a quarterback who, frankly, isn't really that good. He's just put – like, this is the difference between a system that is built to accentuate the strengths of a quarterback versus whatever the fuck that UC did this year. Because there's not – like, Dane Evans has clear limitations. He's not, you know, not that good on the deep ball, not incredibly accurate. His poise under pressure is non-existent. But still, they've crafted a top 20 offense multiple years in a row behind this quarterback. And they don't have half the talent that UC has on the roster. Like, concepts matter. Coaching matters. And UC's just not had much of it this year.
I'm kind of surprised we haven't heard Montgomery mentioned for any coaching rumors. I think he's done a pretty good job at Tulsa his 2 years there.
Baylor. I'm just saying, if they whiff on everybody else, they whiff on Fleck, they whiff on Sonny Dykes. Sonny Dykes decides that he actually likes it in Berkeley. I wouldn't be shocked to see Montgomery go back there.
Do you think they would take him over Chad Morris?
If they could get Chad Morris, they'd take Chad Morris, but I'm not sure Chad Morris wants that job.
That seems like the real interesting part. It's like there's a what Morris decides to do.
That's the thing. Like, opportunities are going to continue to come for Chad Morris. He's good enough. His team is going to be even better next year. He'll get other shots. If you're Philip Montgomery, you might not get this many shots at a job at that level. And there's a lot of baggage that comes with Baylor at this point in time for obvious reasons that we're not really going to discuss here. But you're not going to get too many shots at a job at that level. And if it's offered, I would not be surprised to see him take it. The thing that's going against him, though, is he is definitely part of the Bryles tree. He was on the staff, not when some of the stuff went down, but before that. So that's not exactly a check. You know, that's not exactly a box that you want to check off on your resume at this point in time. So that could be something that holds him back, but I wouldn't be shocked to see him go to that job.
Yeah, just from the Bryles connection, it seems like he'd be more of a long shot than like getting a deserving chance, it seems.
Yeah, but I don't think Baylor's going to get their first, second, third, fourth, or fifth choice. Like, it's a toxic place right there. If you have other options, nobody's going to take that job.
Especially with the exodus of talent they've had lately. Where things are really, really...
And that is mildly. They're going to basically go two full recruiting cycles without any class.
And, like we both acknowledge that Dane Evans isn't the greatest. But he has, like, one of the most prolific passers in Tulsa history. And kind of think the drop-off from him to whoever's next would, like, diminish Tulsa a little bit. Especially since it doesn't seem like Navy and I doubt Houston will be any worse. And you still have Memphis, who is feisty. It wouldn't be that terrible a time to leave.
No, I mean, it really comes down to they're 9-3 this year. Do you think you can get over the mountaintop in that division? I mean, that's a tough ask. Because, I mean, even like if you look at that West division, even Tulane, who is no great shakes, they're not an easy out. They're a tough team. They put up 4 wins this year. I don't think anybody thought they would win 2.
And we mentioned SMU, that program like on the rise. Like that division Division's pretty, like, loaded.
Yeah, between Navy, Tulsa, Houston, I mean, that, you could make the argument, and this is going to rile some people up, but you can make the argument that the AAC West is better than the SEC East. And not just being high, this is not a hot take. Like, you can make a legitimate, factually based argument on that.
And really, it'd be kind of hard to, like, really shoot it down. But just going up through the programs. I get into sure if they had, like, a SEC-AEC challenge, the AEC would probably lose because the bottom tier teams just aren't nearly as talented. But, like, just results-wise this season, I think they've definitely been better, especially at the top.
But enough of worthless hypotheticals.
Although, aren't those the most fun hypotheticals?
Aren't all hypotheticals inherently worthless? They literally bring no value.
Oh, that's actually true. So, let's get back to the game. I think the best part of the game was Teon Green wore Isaiah Pede's jersey. Like, if you weren't aware, Isaiah Pede got in a pretty serious car accident, but ended his playing career. And Teon Green, in his final game as a Bearcat, made that gesture, which was pretty nice.
Yeah, that was a really... It was a moving tribute for Teon to wear that jersey. You know, Isaiah is one of my favorite Bearcats of all time, one of the most fun Bearcats ever, you know, that I've ever watched, regardless of sport. Like, he was just a fun dude to watch.
And he seemed to obviously make a big impact on Teon, since they were both around together. Teon, fifth year senior, I believe. Yes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, like, the season in general, since we're talking about the running backs. Green finished the year with 743 yards. Only two touchdowns. The team as a whole ran for 8 rushing touchdowns, which is really terrible. Was this the big problem with the offense this year? Like, they just couldn't run the ball at all consistently?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking for someone to hang, whose neck to hang this around, it goes on the neck of the offense, because they've just been, they could not do anything on the ground. And, you know, I thought getting J.B. Grimes and given the talent that they had coming back on the interior, that their running game would be better this year. So wrong. Not even close. This was the worst running game I've seen from a UC team ever. Like, even, like, they ran for fewer yards than Brian Kelly's teams. But Brian Kelly's teams were incredibly efficient running the ball when they did. They just didn't run it that much. You know, they'd average 5 yards a carry. I mean, these guys, if you look at the carry stats, it's like 3 yards a carry. You need 4 plays to get a first down at 3 yards a carry. Like, it was just so bad.
Cincinnati finished the year 113th in the rushing S&P. There's only 128 teams that are ranked. One of the worst out of the top in the nation. Go ahead.
I'm surprised they're that high, honestly, because I haven't looked at those stats in weeks just to spare myself the pain. But yeah, you said 113. I'm like, oh, I thought it would be lower.
Yeah, which is always a great sign. Like, even like on the rushing success rate, which is like success in running downs, they were 111th. It's like, really, like, nothing with the running game went remotely the right way. And even with this gigantic offensive production of over 500 yards, nearly 600 yards, UC finished 104 in the offensive S&P, which is their lowest mark since God knows when. The Minter days.
Since ever. In the history, like, literally in the history of the S&P, in the history of Bill C's system, they've never been that low. Like, even the Don Treadwell offenses that everybody bitched about, they were way better than this. They weren't fun, but they were, like, coherent. They were efficient. They did shit. This was just a disaster from start to finish.
And even by scoring 37 points, UC finished the year with 19 points a game. Which, obviously, not surprising, was in the three previous games they scored a combined 13 points. But, just, like, really, offense just fell off a cliff this season. And if there's, like, not wholesale changes, like, it seems like there should be. Like, there's really gotta wonder what the administration is doing.
Yeah, there is no argument for bringing... I mean, do we just want to skip to the big argument? Do we just want to do that?
Yeah, we wrapped up Tulsa. Let's go move on.
There is no coherent argument for bringing Tuberville back. The only reason he is still gainfully employed is that if they wait until the 7th of December, they save themselves, what is it, $950,000 in his buyout clause? Like, yeah. On December 7th, it drops down to 1.5. So, at 12:01, if Mike Bond is not on the phone calling Tuberville and being like, you're done, go get ESPN to pay your salary, you're not coaching again. If he's not doing that, he needs to be fired.
Go have fun on the SEC Network next season.
Yeah, I mean that's what he's going to go do. Because he's not going to be coaching this team. And if he is, there's going to be hell to pay for everyone. Because, like, 20, 30 years ago, this would have been fine. Tuberville would have stuck around for another 5 or 6 years. Because football didn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Nobody really cared. People care now. And when people care, there are expectations that come with that. And the bare minimum of the expectations for the UC program is get to a fucking bowl. That's it. That's the minimum you have to do. Like, there was calls for Butch Jones to get his job taken away after his 4-8 season, but that was his first year. That was in his fourth. Like, there's just... The trend is wrong. The direction of the program is wrong. Tuberville's not going to fix it. He's not capable of fixing it. So, he needs to go. Period.
I don't know, like, what... That great argument you could make for keeping him. That's not, UC doesn't have a ton of money to pay Tuberville and their next coach. Because that's just bullshit. Like, football brings in so much money that you probably would be able to make that back easily. And I'm pretty sure any donors would increase their donations if UC made a hot hire. So you wouldn't really have, it wouldn't be a multiple year issue.
Well, yes. Like, you can bum the donors and be like, hey, we need this money just so that we can fire him. And you can probably draw up enough to get it done and, you know, do some financial magic and find the rest of the money to do it. That's no problem. Here's the real problem. All those suites that we just built, they are going to be coming up. Like, the end of those contracts is after next season. If you bring back Tuberville and we suffer through another one of these seasons, no one's going to renew. So, your entire financial model for your athletic department is predicated on keeping the occupancy rates of those 4,000 luxury suites at 100%. That's the goal. That's what you have to do to make your department work. If you bring back Tuberville, you're not going to get anywhere near 100%. You're not going to get within shouting distance of 100%. You'd be lucky if you got 50%. And then your entire athletic department is swimming in debt and with no real way to pay it, because that's the whole, like, they switched to a model that is based entirely on using the seat license model to fund their payment of the debt that they used in building the suites. That's how it works. And then there's a little bit left over for you to pay the rest of it. If you go down to 50% occupancy in those suites, you're not coming close. You're just not. Like, you need to find that money somehow. Like, there's a real financial incentive to get rid of Tuberville, but they're going to have to wait. We're going to have to wait until December 7th. until that actually happens. Yeah, because that's what they have to do to save that money. And that's just the situation they're in. But if on December 7th he isn't fired, something has gone terribly wrong.
Yeah, if he... Yeah, when that day comes and goes, and he somehow survives the day, like, or survives... See, that's a Wednesday. If he somehow survived into the weekend of, like, December 10th, that'd be insane. Like, there's no way you can go that long with Tuberville as your coach. You really need to get going on recruiting.
And you can't get going on recruiting if everybody thinks your coach is getting fired. Like, everyone is talking to our recruits right now. UC has something like 15 guys committed. They are getting, their phones blowing up because everybody knows Tuberville is gone. And, you know, if you just have this lame duck coach out there, he can't really recruit, can't be like, oh yeah, I'm going to be here for the long haul, while the vultures are circling up above, and you can kind of hear them over the phone. That's not a good sign.
Because it's like some miracle scenario Tuberville does come back. Like, there's no way that they would keep their class together. Like, first off, and I don't think there'd be any way to really guarantee recruits anything for the future, since A, he's old, and B, he's coming off a 4-8 season.
Yeah, I mean, this class is going to fall apart one way or the other. The question is, who do you want to reassemble a class? Do you want it to be Tubbs, or do you want it to be the next guy? I don't even know who the next guy is, but I prefer it to be him.
I think that's one of those things that doesn't bother me too much right now, because I think whoever they hire next, I at least think they'll be aiming higher than where they aim now. Even if it's back to the model of hiring the next hot up-and-coming coach. Like, that worked, and it's really worked for Houston. The only time it didn't work for Houston was when they hired Tony LaVine, and he ended up with pretty good players there. But they won 8 games and they fired him.
Yeah, but Tony LaVine wasn't the next, he wasn't the next guy. He was just the continuity play. Like, he was there before, and it's like, yeah, we know him, so he'll do all right. And that can work. See, Boise State, they basically built their model off that for like 20 years, worked exceptionally well. But you can also have Tony LaVine.
Even Oregon, that worked for so long.
Yeah, Oregon just fired a coach now for the first time since, like, cell phones existed. The last time Oregon fired a coach, cell phones literally didn't exist. Like, their technology didn't exist. It was 1976.
That's just crazy. And I think, like, frick, in a year of hiring, like, one of these coaches, like, I don't know, just, like, use PJ Fleck as an example, since he's, like, the big hot name. Like, there's not that many power jobs available. Like, the biggest Midwestern job right now is Purdue. And God knows what Purdue's going to do for their next coach.
If PJ Fleck takes Purdue, good luck. But I don't think that's going to work for you, bud. Like, Purdue has a lot of institutional factors that are preventing them from being competitive in the Big 12, in the Big Ten. Like, they are not built to compete with the amount of resources that everyone else in that conference has. Like, everybody gets the same check from the network, the Big Ten network. Not everybody spends it the same way. Purdue doesn't spend it. Like, they don't spend it. Like, they just basically, they are the bond that you get when you turn 18 from your aunt who doesn't really like people. Like, that's how they spend their money. Oh, we'll give you a bond. In 100 years, it'll give you $100. Great. I'm 18. I don't think I'm going to last that long.
And like, if that's your major competition in the Midwest, I really think you could land a pretty decent candidate.
Yeah, that's like the first. I would hope to God that Mike Bone has already been on the call, been on the phone with Flex representatives. I don't think he's going to take the job, but you have to make that call. And before you move on to the next candidate, you have to make that call. And if he says no, he says no. But I think they have a good shot with him.
Especially if the rumors are that he does want to stay in the Midwest.
Yeah. And let's be honest, from a resources perspective, UC offers about as much as Purdue does, with the added benefit of having a more engaged fan base than Purdue does. No offense, Purdue. And more fertile recruiting grounds. And really, the difference in facilities and resources is not that big. It's not as big as it should be. Doesn't mean that it'll happen, but it's not as big as it should be. And if he
Really,
says no, move on to Jeff Brohm.
if you think about it, though, like he'd have more time at Purdue to do something than he would at Cincinnati.
That's true, but he would also go into a, he would also have a better roster day one than he would have at Purdue.
That's very true.
Like, this was the worst UC team in a, what, since 2004, 2005? So literally a decade. And they kind of whooped up on Purdue. Like, they were the more physically superior team. They did a lot of stupid shit and turned the ball over and made the game closer than it should have been, but they were comfortably better than Purdue.
Man, Purdue, like, even though they did seem feisty near the end of the season once they fired their coach, like, still, that's a long turnaround. And at Cincinnati, as we've seen pretty much every other school in the AAC that's fired their coach, like, you can hit the ground running and really, really boost up your program and end up in the national spotlight. Because you can't say that the AAC has been out of the spotlight. They've had ranked teams. Last year, they had four ranked teams. This year, Navy's still hanging around in the New Year's Day Bowl picture. It's like it's pretty big for the AAC. And if God help us, if something big happened with the conference, like you'd want to be in like the AAC, I think, than stuck at Purdue, where it's really, really hard to win.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Although Purdue is in the West, where it may not
Purdue
be
is
that
in the
hard to
West,
win.
but Wisconsin isn't going anywhere. Are you kidding me?
This is true.
Wisconsin's just there. Like, Wisconsin is the stereotype of Wisconsin. They are just the fat guy sitting on top of everybody else. They're not moving. You can't push them. They're just there.
Run through the AAC awards that were given out today. No gigantic surprises. Offensive Player of the Year, Quentin Flowers, South Florida. In a different year, if people actually paid attention, like you would get like Dark Horse Heisman buzz. He had a really great year. Defensive Player of the Year, Shaquem Griffin of Central Florida. Memphis had Tony Pollard win the Special Teams Player of the Year. Ed Oliver, unanimous Rookie of the Year. And Coach Ken of Navy wins Coach of the Year for the second year in a row. And you can say his name, but I'm not going to try.
Nematololo.
That's you did it for us. Bearcats wise, Eric Wilson lands on the first team. He was on the second team last year, and second team selection was Cortez Broughton, his first selection to an all AAC team. And that's it. The Bearcats only land two on the teams, which not great.
One of the secondary guys should have gotten a nod, whether it's Mike Tyson or Zach Edwards. One of them should have been there. But whatever.
But then you like to look at they only had four secondary players on the first team. Like all four of those guys pretty much deserve to be there. But I think he could have definitely ended up on the honorable mention list. So that was kind of surprising. So at least Tyson. I thought he had a really good year.
Yeah, Mike Tyson was good all year. I mean, the defense was great. Like, they took such a massive leap from last year. They're going to be even better next year. They have so much young talent. You know, Eric Wilson's, they're going to miss. Mike Tyson, they're going to miss. And obviously, Zach Edwards is a huge loss in the secondary, but they'll be fine because they've been playing all these young guys for the last 2 years. And this next year is when you would expect them to turn the corner, and they probably should. And you get, you know, it's not just that you're bringing everybody back. You're also, like, you know, Bryce Jenkinson didn't play hardly a minute of this season. He redshirted. He'll be back. You know, that kind of fills some of the holes at the linebacker position. The defensive line is still going to be stacked. Cortez Broughton is a monster and is only going to get better from here. You know, there's a lot to like with the way that this roster is built. Yeah, and that's credit to Tubbs. You know, that's not a popular thing to say at this moment, but he did a great job of building up the roster in ways that Butch Jones neglected. He just didn't do much with the natural talent that these guys had. He didn't do a whole lot to put them in position to succeed. And that's ultimately why he's going to get fired. But there's a lot to like with this defense going forward.
Yeah, Broughton's definitely going to be preseason first team for sure. So not without even considering it, half the first team defensive line is moving on. That he's going to be he's probably going to get votes, I think, for preseason player of the year, defensive player of the year, if that's an actual award.
No, he won't, because Ed Oliver.
I said votes. Ed Oliver may not get it unanimously.
Ed Oliver is arguably the best defensive lineman in the country. And he's 18.
And Griffin is only a junior, and he'll probably get votes, too. Third place votes is still a vote.
Okay.
Even though they don't vote like that.
But yeah, I love Cortez Broughton. I think he's going to be a phenomenal player for UC for the next 2 years. Ed Oliver is just a monster. Like, he's just a different level.
Just like, worth mentioning, looking through the conference first team, UC really helped these guys end up with their first team selections. Like, Zay Jones, East Carolina, huge game against UC. Kevin Lucas would have made it anyway, but he had a huge game against the Bearcats. Obviously, Flowers did. Marlon Mack, of course. Flanders, we mentioned earlier. They pretty much helped the whole entire offense end up with a first-team selection, so that was really nice of them.
Yeah, and most of those games happened after the team quit on the coaches. Like, all of those games happened after the writing was clearly on the wall. And what, two of those performances came after Tuberville yelled at a fan, which is obviously just a power move that you always do, right? You yell at fans. You yell at people who pay your salary.
Definitely. How else do you get the message across?
I mean, that's how I get a raise at work every time I want one. I just yell at customers. It works like a charm. Works perfectly. You never get in trouble for that.
At least that's going to be the best part of when Tuberville gets fired. People can post that clip over and over and over again.
Oh, I got it saved. I'm ready to go.
Yeah. Also worth mentioning, Jake Elliott, first team kicker all 4 years at Memphis. First year at Memphis, he was not the special teams player of the year. Also, Greg Ward, for his, like, great Houston run, second team both times, just really kind of it's not surprising when you look at, like, the two quarterbacks who were the offensive players of the year. But, like, in the grand scheme of things, it's like you think Greg Ward would have ended up on the first team somehow. But no.
Well, yeah, it's just one of those, like, Tony Pike, arguably the best quarterback in UC history. Never first team all conference. I believe that's correct. Because, you know, he played 1 year with a broken arm for half the games or whatever.
And Pat White had a crazy year, I believe.
Yeah. Shit happens.
was just looking at the conference play, offensive players of the year. It's like Shane Carden really stands out. How the hell did Shane Carden win offensive player of the year?
Yeah, that one. One of these things is not like the other.
Let's just wrap up the AAC as a whole. And play a game where we're just going to call it a successful season or an unsuccessful season. We'll start in the East, since that's the crappy division. East Carolina went 3-9, 1-7 in the league. They gave up 322 points in conference play, which was not the most, but the second most. So I'm going to just assume we both think they had a bad season.
Yeah, bad season.
UConn, they beat Cincinnati. I think that was the end of their season, I believe. They just packed it up after that game.
That's the one.
They only scored 117 points in their 8 AAC games, which is really, really bad.
You know, this is where we find out the limitations of being handsome. Because how much longer can Bob Diaco keep his job just by being handsome?
Because
on results, he should be fired.
You got to think UConn will be looking to make a move.
Yeah. But
there's really, like, I haven't heard any rumors about his job security.
There was a post that I saw on a message board, which, you know, great sourcing. So there was this guy who joined a message board when it's uncommitted, and, you know, there have been rumors swirling that Diaco is not going to be around much longer, either this year or next year. So they reached out to Diaco trying to get something. Their calls went unreturned for a week, and then this kid decommitted. And the basic point of the message board post was, I don't know what the fuck your guy is doing. You probably need a new one. And then everyone on the message board just, like, slit their wrist and died.
That sounds about right.
Hey, but you still got women's basketball, so that's nothing.
UConn scored 20 points against Cincinnati, scored 27 against USF, and scored 16-3-0-0 and 13 in a humiliating loss against Tulane. Yeah, you got to think to Bob Diaco. If he's not on the hot seat now, next year is definitely a make or break for him. Probably break. I can't imagine that they'll make a bowl game. At Cincinnati, we've covered a lot. Central Florida went 6-6, 4-4 in the league. They did drop their final two games. What were your overall impressions of their season?
Scott Frost is a god. He. By far the best hire of last season for any AAC coach. He's just really good. He turned, like, his talent. The talent of that team is still not great. They still need a lot of work to do there. But what he did with the resources he had was pretty incredible. Because where this shows up in being able to do something like that in your first year is your level of organizational detail. And that's a big part of the coaching, is success in coaching. That's what separates the great coaches, your Sabins, your Myers, your Harbaughs, from the rest of them. Because there's a lot of good coaches. There's not many great coaches. And the great coaches are the ones who are the most organized and most prepared. And when you can come into a situation where you don't have a lot of talent, you don't have time, you don't really get to put together a full recruiting class, and you can pull out a bowl-eligible 6-6 season from a roster that just went 0-12, that shows a lot. He's really good.
a huge example of, like, just take care of business against the teams that you should beat, and you can end up in a bowl game, which is pretty much exactly what they did. Like, their losses were to Michigan, Maryland, Temple, Houston, Tulsa, and South Florida, which were by far the best teams they played. And they beat all the other teams that were under them in the standings. Do you think Scott Frost will end up at Oregon?
No, actually, the rumor is Oregon is going to go AAC, but they're going after Willie Taggart. That's the most recent rumor that I saw before we hopped on this pod.
It's the one going across on the ESPN bottom line.
Yeah, I think it's a year too soon for this opening for Frost. I think eventually he'll get back there, or Nebraska, for obvious reasons. But the timing wasn't right this year.
Well, speaking of Willie Taggart, South Florida 10-2, 7-1 in the conference. They lost to Temple, so they don't make the title game. They scored 523 points, which were the most in the league by 80 points, which is pretty, or 70 points, which is pretty good.
Yeah, they were incredible on offense and just good enough on defense.
Whoops, I skipped past Tulsa, so they did it by 30 points. So, yeah, like, their defense just good enough to get turnovers, get stops, and nobody could stop Flowers and Matt consistently. Check if you can watch any of the game against Central Florida. That's pretty much what happens, that UCF hung in there a little bit, then like, oh, no, there goes Mac for 80 yards. There goes Flowers for 50, and it's over.
Yeah, I mean, Taggart really stuck with his plan. He had a, like, he came in trying to make them into Stanford East. Obviously, that wasn't going to work in Florida. So he changed his tack and went a different route with his offense, and the last 2 years have been by far the best of his tenure, and he's in a position to take a massive leap in terms of pay grade, prestige, and whatever program he chooses to run. Yeah, we've been there with you, Bulls. This isn't fun, but you know you can't keep him forever.
I think even in the important thing is, like, he did leave that program in, like, a position where, like, if he does leave, like, they'll still be in pretty good shape for next year. They'll at least have Flowers and Mac back.
Yeah, unless they hire a Cragthorpe or something like that, they should be fine.
Don't, you could even say a Skip Holtz. Just burn that, right? They drive that dagger in.
Oh, yeah, Skip Holtz is hot again. Yeah, go La Tech.
Temple won the East. They went 7-1 in the league, 9-3 overall. They got off to a terrible start where they lost to Army. And then pretty much from there on out, like, they played really well. Like, their only losses were at Penn State and at Memphis, and by the same score, 34-27. They finished year winning 6 in a row, and I kind of think they're going to win the title game.
I don't know. I like Navy. Yeah, but Temple was incredible this year. We both thought, all three of us really thought that they were going to take a step back with losing all those seniors on defense. And it turns out, not so much. Yeah, they were fine. The offense found some skill position players, especially at running back. And the receivers were markedly better this year than they were last year. And yeah, we talked about Dane Evans earlier being a quarterback who has obvious limitations that they can work around. Pinion Walker has some pretty obvious limitations, but he does enough things well enough and at a high enough level that it really doesn't matter for Temple. He just needed a little bit of help. And when his skill position guys finally rounded into form at the end of September, they were a monster.
Yeah, we ragged on PJ Walker or Phillip Walker a lot earlier in the season. He finished with 2,700 yards, 18 touchdowns, 12 interceptions. Like, their passing game by the S&P numbers ranked 34th, which was really incredible from where they started and where they ended up.
Yeah, I mean, it was a dramatic transformation. He was just really, really good. Yeah, he still did those spectacular plays, but really the difference between any good quarterback and a great quarterback is their ability to limit mistakes. And he really cut them completely out of his diet. He threw 12 interceptions, but he was averaging like 20 a season for the previous 3 years. So going down to 12 is a marked improvement.
And it seemed like a lot came early in the season when he was really struggling. And like you said, like once they got going, those big plays started coming in the passing game, and the running backs were both insane. Thomas and Armstead. They both had like around 850 yards and combined for 25 touchdowns, which is pretty good if you can get it.
Yeah, if either of those guys isn't on the team, one of those guys has a very strong case to be Offensive Player of the Year. I still think it would be Flowers, but they would have a great argument to make. Because they'd probably put up 1,500 yards and 20 touchdowns. That's all they just need is that.
Not at all. Try to pull up the conference list again. But let's move on to the West. We start at the bottom. Tulane, they finished 4-8. They won their final game of the regular season, as we mentioned, against UConn. They were kind of an interesting team this year. They performed a lot better than...
They were way better than I thought they would be. I thought they would be good next year, because usually when you know, it's not the first year, it's the second year with a coach, you know, under a new coach where they make the leap. You know, Willie Fritz is just really, he's just a really good football coach. Bottom line, bar none, he's just really good at his job. That's a pretty... Like, if you're going to line up the AAC teams in terms of overall talent level, Tulane is probably right above Navy. Just right above, like, 11th. They don't have the athletes that some of these other teams have, but it didn't really matter because they just played at such a higher level than they should have been capable of. And, you know, Navy does this year after year, which is why the AAC Coach of the Year award will eventually be named after Ken Niumatalolu. But, I mean, what they did this year was pretty incredible. I didn't expect them to win two games. They won four.
And take out the Temple game and the Central Florida game where they got blown out. And they were in every other game. Memphis only beat them by 10. They had a shootout against Tulsa. Barely lost against SMU. Like, gave Houston hell. Houston had to come back in that game to beat Tulane. SMU finished 5-7, 3-5 in the league. They had a chance to be bowl eligible, but they couldn't win either their final two games against Central Florida or Navy. They got dunked on by Navy. Gave up 75 points, which is kind of nasty.
They're fun. They're not good, but they're fun. And look, after the year we just endured, I would like pay someone dearly for fun and not good. Because not fun and not good is really bad. Like, that's a fall you want to forget.
We mentioned Chad Morris earlier today. He agreed to a contract extension through 2023.
So, something tells me I don't think he's going to see out that contract.
I think you're
call
right.
Call it a hunch. Call it a hunch.
I think you're right, but it seems like it's going to take him out of the running this season.
Yeah, it's going to take him. I think he's going to take a pass on this season. He's just waiting for Dabo to go become a Pentecostal minister, and then he's going to take over Clemson.
Oh, and the good news for UC is that SMU rolls on the schedule next year.
Yay!
Memphis finished the year 8-4, 5-3 in the AAC. I think they did right up to the expectations line. I don't think they did any better or worse
They exceeded my expectations. I did not have high expectations for this team, this particular team, or Norvell in general. But, yeah, I was wrong. They look to be just as good as they were under Fuente. We'll see if he can maintain that when he starts bringing in his own players. But he obviously has no problem taking over a roster and maximizing the talent on it. That's for sure. Now, can he recruit and develop his own? That's going to be the difference with Norvell. This might be a scenario where he coasts for 2 or 3 years on Fuente's guys and then bounces. Or he could stick around for a little bit and reap the rewards until the right job comes open for him.
But you do have to be, if you're a Memphis supporter, you do have to be encouraged with how Ferguson played down the stretch. I think he was really impressive.
Yeah, I didn't have any expectations for him at all coming into this year, but he was good.
And that game with Houston was pretty crazy. A good way for the league to go out on. Because assuming the Navy-Temple game is what everybody thinks it will be. But speaking of Houston, they finished 9-3, 5-3 in the league. It seems like it was a bad year for Houston, I'm going to say. Because they did lose 3 times on the road, all 3 games. Which, like, nothing terrible, but they did end with a losing record on the road, which nobody pegged coming into the season.
Well, you know, Tom Herman is often portrayed as a mini Urban Meyer, and he kind of is, right down to the unexplicable head-scratching loss to teams that they're obviously better than in weird circumstances. And they had 2 of those. Almost had 3. They almost lost to Tulane.
Like, they should have lost to Tulsa.
Yes. They definitely should have lost to Tulsa. Yeah, I mean, like, nobody's better at getting teams up for, you know, for the big game than Urban Meyer. And Tom Herman was there when they orchestrated the giant slaying of Alabama. Like, that's what they're good at. It's the other games where you have to worry. And this year they had to worry quite a bit because... I mean, let's go back to week 3. UC gave them hell. And UC, as it turns out, sucks at football.
Yeah, I think we let the margin of that game, like the final score, like cloud our opinion on Houston a little bit, since they did hang 40 and won comfortably. Because, like, once they got into the heart of their league schedule, they looked... really pedestrian. I believe we even said that on the podcast. And that's the reason they were gigantic underdogs to Louisville. And as you mentioned, they pulled the big game Houston, big game Urban Meyer thing and just came out and just smacked them in the face.
Yeah, I mean, like, the Louisville game is so weird to me because their biggest strength was perfectly aligned to attack Louisville's biggest weakness. Louisville's offensive line is pretty shitty. For a team that good, their line is not that good. Lamar Jackson is amazing, but that line is not. And they just attacked relentlessly downhill. They just went after that line and just dominated from start to finish.
Do you think Houston goes out of the box big higher, or do you think that Todd Orlando or Major Applewhite have a big chance of landing this job? So it doesn't seem like Major Applewhite is going to end up at Texas, from what people are saying.
I mean, it's tough. Continuity hires are tough. It's impossible to tell. Because the skills required to successfully be an offensive or defensive coordinator are not related at all to successfully being a head coach. Sometimes that works. Yeah, you know, like we talked about Boise State 40 minutes ago as the example of how this can work. And Oregon as well. But there's no way to tell because you're basing it off your intimate knowledge of someone's working ability and how they, you know, go about their day and how they conduct their business. that is something that you don't get when you're interviewing an outside candidate. So you have a little bit of a leg up there. But on the other side, you don't know what these internal guys are going to do because they have no track record other than what you've done with them every day. Now, if you look at somebody who's coming outside from another place, they have a proven track record. They can point to their record, literally. I won this many games. I am this good. And whether or not that is actually a meaningful thing, it complicates the hiring process because going with an outside guy gives you more information. It might not be the kind of information you need, but there's more to base it on. If I were them, given the way they have things rolling off the field, I would go internal. I would go after Applewhite because he does have a bright future in this profession, and he's going to get that job eventually. This might be a 2-3-4 years too soon for him, you know, in an ideal world, but I think he can handle it.
And it seemed like when they hired Major Applewhite, it was one of those things where he was either going to be the coach when Herman left, or if Herman stayed longer than two seasons, he was going to be a coaching name for somewhere else.
Yeah, he was going to be a Lincoln Riley. You know, somebody that just goes somewhere else to rejuvenate a moribund offense.
Houston has lost a couple of higher profile recruits, but I think overall they'll be fine once they get things settled out. Navy finished, but they haven't finished yet. They still have two games remaining on their schedule since they play Army. They're 9-2, 7-1 in the league. So instead of like wrapping up their season as a whole, do you think that Navy will end up with a Group of Five spot, or do you think they'll lose it out to Western Michigan?
If PJ Fleck rows that damn boat, he's going to be rowing it to the Cotton Bowl. And then probably Eugene.
Put up the rankings. Let's see where they rank. Western Michigan right now is 17th. Navy is 19th. I think there's a chance that Navy could pass them up in the rankings. I don't know. Somebody's at the door.
Sorry about that.
You have any lingering thoughts on the AAC, or do you want to move on to basketball before we close things out?
I just want to say it's a good thing I don't have a dog.
You know, why is that?
Because I'm frequently ruining, you know, podcast audio quality. I don't get many door knocks. Dogs like to bark.
That did make things dramatic for a minute there.
Yeah, it was just somebody assassinating me. Don't worry about it. I'm fine.
We haven't talked basketball since we took our little hiatus once the season started. Bearcats 5-1. The lone loss to Rhode Island. The kind of nightmare scenario for your non-conference hopes and dreams, since UC missed out on a game against Duke. The game they probably wouldn't have won, but the game you'd still like to have anyway. Hey, Rhode Island game that just really justified your Kevin Johnson vitriol from the preseason. UC had that big lead, and he would miss, what, like three shots in a row, and it was a one-possession game.
Yeah, it was. His offensive rating is like 60. 100 is average.
On KenPom, it's 71.9.
Oh, it's going up? Oh, I haven't checked the most. I gotta log on to KenPom real quick. Hold on.
Yeah, which is the worst on the team. Oh, not the worst. Quadri Moore is somehow worse.
Wow, it's 79.1. That is, wow, almost within two standard deviations of average. So that's marked improvement.
Still holding off quad. At some point, Quadri Moore won't be a frustrating player to watch, will he? Or is this just going to be Quadri Moore? He's going to be our... oh, what's the guy's name on the Warriors? He'll be our JaVale McGee.
Oh, now that you said that, I cannot think of him as not our JaVale McGee.
I think the impressive thing about Quad is how he's just come in and shoot, no matter what.
He is putting up shots. He is putting up shots. He does not care. He is in that game to do one thing. Shoot. Doesn't matter. He is gonna shoot. Here's the thing about Quadri Moore. He has the attitude that you want your walk-on to have. Where they get in the game and they have no conscience and they are just launching. The problem is, he actually kind of has to be a rotation player. He has to play like 10 minutes a game and not do stupid shit. And that's a problem because he's incapable of not just doing stupid shit. Like,
he's going to be out of position. He's going to turn the ball over. He's going to do Quad things.
You know what? Here's how you think about Quad. It's not just as the JaVale McGee of the Bearcats. He's like a Jackson Pollock painting. You have to look through it. You have to look really deep into it to get a fuller understanding of what he's doing. Because on the surface, it's just all dots and chaos, and it makes no sense. But there is something there.
There's a...
He's like modern art. He really is.
Why don't we just run up and down the roster since that's apparently what we're doing now. We start at the top since we just start at the bottom. Kyle Washington, averaging nearly a double-double. Seemed like the more skeptical one out of all of us about Kyle Washington. And I was very wrong because he's been really great. Like nearly 17 points, 9 rebounds, nearly 2 assists, nearly 2 blocks. Shooting really well from the floor. He's been pretty good at the line, nearly 71%. You can say a lot of good things about Kyle Washington.
Yeah, I mean, he's been better than I expected him to be, and I expected him to be pretty good. The weird thing about this team currently is there is so much talent, but like it doesn't quite fit together. Like Kyle Washington's great, and his numbers are phenomenal, but if you look at the roster and how, you know, touches are being distributed, he is using 28% of all possessions. Gary Clark is only using 16, and that's because they play in the same area. Like, they need to find a way to get those two guys to function more coherently than they have early in the season. You know, this is still a small sample size theater. We've only played 6 games. These numbers can swing drastically as you add more data points. But that is the biggest takeaway that I've had this first year, is that him and Gary Clark don't quite fit as well as I thought they would. Not nearly as well as Gary and Octavius Ellis did. Because Octavius Ellis was just a pick-and-roll man. He was just going to pick and dive to the hoop. That's all he could really do. That was the extent of his offensive capabilities. Gary was more the in-the-post, back-to-the-basket kind of guy. Kyle Washington and Gary are both very similar in how they play. Given, you know, if they have a say in how they're being, you know, used, they're both going to choose to be put on the block to go to work one-on-one against people. That's kind of a problem. That's a little bit of an awkward fit. They can make it work, and they have made it work by, you know, this is by far the best offense of the Mick Cronin era. It's still, to my mind, not good enough because they're wasting a lot of possessions. Let's just put it that way. But
well, we've seen what they did against the wall one material good team there. They played. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, the raw material is there for this to be an even better offense. Like, there is enough talent here for this to be a top 20 offense. No joke. But to get it there, Mick has to make some tough decisions. he has to figure out how to get Kyle Washington and Gary Clark to work together for 30 minutes a night, where it's not one guy's on, the other guy's off. You got to have both of them playing well at the same time. You got to figure out more ways to get Troy Copain involved shooting, because right now his shooting numbers are not good. And then the other thing is, you need to, I hate to come back to this, but we're going to play the hits, damn it. You need to find a way to take 15 of Kevin Johnson's minutes and give them to one of Justin Jennifer, Evans, or Cumberland. Like, you need to be more, adventurous in how you use your lineup. Because this team has the ability to go super big, with Gary at the three if they want to, and go with Evans and Copain in the backcourt, where nobody is smaller than 6'4", or they can go super small. They have those options. And Mick has not shown a willingness to do that kind of stuff against the teams that suck, but that's the stuff you have to do against good teams to beat good teams. Like, you have to just throw different things at them. His unwillingness to do that so far with a roster that's clearly capable of more than it's shown is worrying, especially if your goal is you want this to be a Final Four team. And we all do. And this team has that capability. There's no doubt about that at this point. It's just, how much is Mick willing to change and adapt what he does to get the most out of this offense? Because the defense is still good, but this offense is good and needs to be even better if you want to get to that level.
I definitely agree. You hit on a lot of the issues that I was going to bring up as well. Let's stay with the guards real quick. Because one thing you mentioned was the outside shooting, especially with Copain. Like, you'd hope whatever hitch was in his shot last year would get fixed. And so far, against 24 shots, but his shot is still off. He's 7 of 24 from 3. Like, you just, go down, Cumberland had a good, made his first threes of the season the other day. Like, he hasn't been that great from three. Kevin Johnson, yeah. And, you got your main three-point shooters have really been Evans and Jennifer. And we've seen Jennifer's minutes yo-yo a ton. It's like Evans has been the one who's really taken the star turn.
Evans has been phenomenal. He's been the best player on this team by a mile. I would not have seen that coming, but he has been that good. And that's the thing about him that I love, is that everyone else on this team, because of how much Mick coaches, struggles for confidence. And it's not just Mick is a hard ass. He's hard on his players, and he generally recruits. Let's be blunt about it. He recruits dudes that are shy. If you hear Troy Copain talk, if you hear Gary Clark talk, they are shy guys. That's how they come across. That's how they sound. They're not aggressive in your face dudes. Jacob Evans will fucking slit your throat and laugh at you. He is a dog. He is coming to work. And they need that guy. The best team in the mid-Cronin era so far has been the Sweet 16 team. And that team had Deion Dixon. Deion Dixon wasn't that good, but Deion Dixon thought he was the best player on earth. And the team fed off that energy. Evans has that vibe, but he's also the best player on the team. A guy who, by the way he's playing right now, has All-American capabilities. And I don't throw that around lightly. He can be that good.
I think you could definitely argue he's the best player and probably, but overall, the best playmaker on the team with what he brings offensively,
no doubt,
and defensively.
No doubt. And, here's the other, he doesn't have to have the ball to be effective. Troy Cobain has to have the ball, and he has to pound at the top of the key for 15 seconds to feel, I don't know if it's that he has to do that to feel like he's being, having a contribution to the team, but my God, Troy, you need to stop. You need to realize that this team is better if you have the ball less. And the only person who can really force that realization upon him is Mick. Is Mick willing to do that, or is he just going to say, we're going to go as far as Troy goes? You can get pretty far with Troy Copain as your best player, going as far as Troy goes. Like, you can get to the Sweet 16. No problem. You can get there with this group. I have no doubts about that. If you want to go beyond that, Troy can't be your best guy. He can't be the one that you turn to at the end. And increasingly, he's not. They're giving the ball to Jacob Evans and just saying, go to work, son. Like, go do you. And I don't particularly like that kind of basketball, but it's so effective with Evans because he is an effective and willing passer. And he is by far the best offensive player in the Mick Cronin era. Like, we're two games in. His ceiling is much higher than SK's was. SK couldn't do the things that he's doing now at this stage of his career. He got there at the end, but not at this age.
Oh, definitely. And he wasn't as good a long-distance shooter as Evans has been either.
Yeah, SK was volume. Evans is, like, a dead-eye. His true shooting percentage is over 65% last I checked. That's insane for a guard.
His true shooting percentage is 72.5%, which is 29th in the country.
And he's let that guy shoot.
46% from three, 70% from two, 81% from the foul line. They're the only player on the team who can make free throws besides Cumberland in the last game. Which is another big problem, is how is this team so terrible at the free throw line? I don't really understand why they're not good.
Yeah, and the funny thing, like, Gary was good last year, and he's down to 53%. Kyle Washington is not quite that, like, he's at 70, which is fine. You can kind of live with that. But Troy is shooting, what, under 70%? Kevin Johnson, like everything else, he can't shoot anything.
Troy only has 9 attempts. He has less free throw attempts than Nysir Brooks, which is insane because we played 6 games and he's taken 9 free throws.
That's a problem.
Like, I
think and that's just generally the problem with relying on Troy to the extent that they have early in the season. Like, Troy is a good player. He's a very good player. He's an all-conference kind of guy. Like, and that's nothing to sneeze at. But it's the question is, how good do you want to be? If you just want to win the conference, go to the NCAA, maybe win a game or two, and call it a year, then keep relying on Troy. And he'll get you there, no problem. But if you want to go beyond that, you need to start turning the team over to Jacob Evans. You just do. You just need to hand him the keys and take him as far as he takes you. And that'll be pretty far because there's a lot of talent around the team and there's a lot of ways that there's so many diverse talents with this team that they can play different ways. Like, I would like to see way more looks where you have Evans, Copain, and Justin Jennifer as your three guards. That's a devastating backcourt. But that group has played a handful of minutes, probably less than 15. But you just need to start, you know, Mick really needs to start experimenting in these non-conference games with different ways to play, because you're going to have these things in your back pocket when you get to the tournament. All the good teams, the teams that make far runs, they have that ability to just say, oh, okay, so you're ready for us to play this way? Okay, well, we're going to play this way now. What's your answer to that? Like, you have to have answers to their answers. You can't just keep circling A the entire test. Expect to get a 90.
Sometimes you have to pick B or C.
I know, it's tough. Those could be wrong, but you have to guess something other than A.
Every test I get, I had to guess, I always guess C.
Statistically, the most likely to be correct. I don't know. Somebody told me that in college. I really believed him. I got my degree. Am I wrong? Is that wrong?
That's not right, but I think that is true.
C's get degrees, man. Just the grades, but like the answers.
Because they never put the answer in A. That's always the rarity. And D's like the normally like the you overthink it and circle D.
Yeah, seed's where it's at, man.
You mentioned, like, this changing up the offense and playing to your opponent. It brings up an interesting test for the Bearcats. We're recording this on Wednesday night. which will be posted either tonight or Thursday, and later on Thursday night, the Bearcats go to Iowa State. They're a bit of an underdog, of course, since Iowa State's pretty good, and it's in Ames. I'm really interested to see where the Bearcats play against, like, such a tough team. It's against Rhode Island. Like, they really let Rhode Island just take that game from them. And it was really disappointing. Especially, like, one issue we really haven't mentioned is how UC's just been killed on the offensive glass. And they haven't played anybody good besides Rhode Island. And that's going to be a problem against Iowa State, who's, like, not a great offensive rebounding team. But it's something that they do pretty well.
Yeah, it's shocking how bad UC is defensive rebounding these years. It's not just this year, it's last year as well. Like, it's been 2 years where they've been pretty mediocre by UC standards on the defensive glass. And that's a problem. Like, that's the biggest reason why they lost, what, three of the four games they lost? You know, last year, Butler, the Iowa State game, like, they just couldn't clear the glass. They couldn't end possessions. And that has continued earlier on this year is not great. Not great.
I think one, like, major thing you have to look at is, like, Gary Clark, like, only 15% on the defensive glass. That was way down for him. He was at 19% and 20% last year. Like, his play as a whole, you mentioned it earlier, it's like, whatever is not working between him and Washington, it's kind of surprising. It's like, good thing it's early. But, like, it doesn't look like a great trend for the season when you expect Gary Clark to take, like, the superstar leap, and he's 7.6 rebounds.
Yeah, I mean, I've been disappointed with how he's played earlier in this year. And part of that might be that he's not completely healthy. I've heard whispers and rumblings about that. I'm not sure that I buy that. If he wasn't healthy, he wouldn't be playing in these meaningless games, let's be honest.
But he did barely play in the last game.
Yes. And that was because of an ankle injury. But I think there were rumblings coming out of camp that he wasn't, that something was off with him physically. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they don't play Gary at all tomorrow and they kind of, like, have to go about it a different way. I don't think that's going to happen. But, like, he hasn't looked like a guy who's been healthy. Like, he doesn't have the same bounce and explosiveness that we're used to.
But to that point, they haven't limited his minutes pretty much at all. He played the high 20s, low 20s against Albany, and that game was a gigantic blowout. But he played pretty much the whole game against Rhode Island and pretty much the whole game against Samford. When we didn't mention that game at all. Like, that little 30-minute panic attack. But his minutes, they do make you wonder, like, how healthy he is, and, like, that the fact that they rested him against Lipscomb to I guess to keep him in the lineup for Iowa State does bring up some concern.
Yeah, and, like, they're gonna need him to be healthy down the stretch, so, like, I don't worry. Like, this isn't a game that UC has to have for tournament purposes. I think that playing the schedule that they're going to play this year, they're going to get enough quality wins that even if they don't win the AAC like they were predicted to, they should have enough to get there. In a large capacity, especially with the way that UConn is, I don't know, like, imploded, might be a good word there.
I think you'd be just looking really at your problem would be the seeding, like where you ended up seeded. It's going to be the major issue. Because really, nobody in the conference outside of Temple has any kind of legit win. And Temple, like, lost to New Hampshire and UMass. So, well, they're kind of back to being a weird Temple again.
Well, let's be real. Temple's always weird. They are just a weirdly constructed team.
I think they played, like six people. It's like all their players are hurt. Fran's like a crazy coach. I don't know.
Fran is ridiculous.
I really don't know.
He does not get enough credit for how crazy he is. Because he did, like, if you watch Temple, the style that they play with does not match the demeanor of their coach.
Definitely not. They played eight players in their last game, and one of them played 10 minutes.
So they played seven.
And like they're one of those teams. They have Echinoya, and like if you have a star, like we've seen Temple, like pretty much they have a star, and like they're good. Good enough to you can't take them lightly.
Yes, but back to Iowa State.
let's not concentrate on January games. I think it's going to be a big test for Copain. Obviously, it's like last year he was pretty much almost up to the challenge against Monty Morris. So Monty Morris is having another great year. That's going to be if they can slow him down at all. Him and Burton have been like crazy. That's the big matchup, I think, is how well your guards defend.
Yeah, and the funny thing with Burton this year is early on, he's absorbing an enormous amount of possessions, but he's not been efficient. He's had some big scoring games, but like on the whole, he's just been kind of average in terms of offensive efficiency. I don't think that's going to hold for the season. I think this is an early season trend that will change. I just hope it doesn't change tomorrow, because they are going to struggle. Like, they ate apart UC's defense last year. Let's be real. Like, they just didn't have an answer for it. They were so good about methodically exploiting weaknesses and matchups with how UC likes to play their matchup zone, and they just killed it. And they didn't just kill it for a little bit. They killed it all game long. UC was in it with a chance to win, but with the way they defended, they should not have been in that game at all. Like, they were so bad defensively. If they get a repeat of that, that's a big problem, because UC doesn't defend the rim this year like they did last year. Not against good teams. You know, they've put up like hilarious block stats and rim protection stats against the shitty teams. Rhode Island got whatever they wanted at the rim. Like, they just collapsed that defense so easily and so often that I got real concerns about their ability to hold up to penetration against Iowa State.
Yeah, and that's my major worry as well. Because like, playing in a place like that, too, it's just so hard to play. And like just college basketball, the way it is, like nobody plays road games anymore. And it's your first big road test is going to Ames for Hilton Magic. So good luck with that.
Yeah, it's going to be... I have a feeling... Like, don't get me wrong. This team is absolutely capable of going into Ames and getting a win. This is not a vintage Iowa State team. It's a very good one, but it's not among the best of the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, definitely not.
They are capable of going in there and getting a win. But given what I've seen in terms of their ability to utilize the pieces that they have in new and interesting ways, which is stuff you have to do against good teams. And Mick just doesn't seem to have that club in his bag. And that's a real problem when you go on the road against a team of this quality. And like, I just got real, real deep concerns about how this game is going to play out.
Like you mentioned last year's game, like, it ended up being like kind of an Iowa State type of up and down game. It would be interesting to see if UC guy gets into that type of game again this year. Like with no like George Niang like out there, it's like he was really the reason UC lost last year. Because he made what like the tying three, then he helped on the winning shot, I believe.
Yeah, he was phenomenal in the last 10 minutes of that game. Like he didn't like that wasn't a game for him where he dominated start to finish. Like he had a slow start. Octavius Ellis gave him all kinds of hell on the interior. But when he started, you know, stretching out, you know, Akba going up outside the 3-point line, that's when he got into his groove, and that's when UC really fell apart with their defensive shape. So not having him helps, but like I really worry about their guard penetration, and I really worry about Mix, like, this is a game where Kevin Johnson shouldn't play more than 10 minutes. Honestly. He brings nothing. He does not defend well enough to justify how bad he is in offense. And you're going to have to score in this environment. Like, this isn't going to be a 55-50 game. Iowa State generally doesn't play those at home. So you're going to have to run with these guys. So you have to have your best players to play in that environment. And UC's got 7-8 guys who can play it that way and be effective. But is Mick willing to give up the dream of controlling tempo to kind of run with them and let them go? Because I really think that's the only way that they're going to have a chance, because you're not going to control tempo for 40 minutes against Iowa State. They're too good, and that place is too raucous an environment for you to dictate terms that way.
And if a team like Gonzaga couldn't do it, I don't think there's a lot of like major hope that a team like Cincinnati would be able to do the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
I think
they want to play one way. You're going to have to beat them playing their way.
I think one of the things that does go in Iowa State's favor is like the fact they have played some harder competition. Like, they just came out of a tournament where they played Miami and Gonzaga, and UC's like playing pretty bad teams lately. And like that does have a pretty big impact. Like, once you step up to real competition, like, you have to like match that intensity, and it's really hard to do for college kids on the road.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line though, UC can win this game. I don't have the best feeling about it. They have that capability, but they're going to have to show something that they haven't shown to this point in the year. A willingness and an ability to change tempos, essentially, to change the way that they play.
Yeah, and you're going to have Clark and Washington dominate inside. Like, you have to take advantage of Iowa State. Like, none of their big guys do anything. If like they're going to beat you, it's going to be Burton, Long, and Morris. Like, they're three guards who are good.
Yeah, I mean, they play three guards. They don't really have big men in the traditional sense. Like, UC's got four guys who are probably going to play who are over 6'8". Five guys. You gotta take advantage of that size advantage.
Iowa State against Gonzaga played eight players, and two of them were over 6'6". So, like, that's what you're really looking at. Like, Iowa State's going to play, like, their team, and you have to shut them down, or you're in trouble. Especially with Morris, who hasn't been shooting great, but we all know how good a playmaker he is. He's one of the best guards in the nation for a reason.
Yeah, I still have nightmares about him.
Is there anything else you want to get off your chest this week before we call out a podcast?
Sean Kilpatrick's making himself some money. He's had a phenomenal... I know not everybody here is an NBA fan. Don't worry, I'll watch for you. It's fine. He's playing for one of the worst teams in the NBA. The Nets suck. They're terrible. But he's been phenomenal. He's been an incredible find for them, and he is playing like he's going to be an NBA player for a very long time. And I couldn't be happier for him.
Every story you read about him in the pros, it's like how much he's really won everybody over with his hard work and determination. And like for people who got to watch him for 4 years, it's like, yeah, like that's who he is. That's how he plays. And it's good to see him getting like that type of success. And him as like a point guard is kind of interesting too. I'm kind of surprised he's like been so adept in the pros at running the point.
Yeah, Mick loves to tell a story about how when SK got here, he literally couldn't dribble, and now he's a point guard in the NBA. And that is by necessity. You know, the Nets point guards are injured and not doing well, obviously. But he's taken full advantage of this opportunity. He put up 38-14 in a win against the Clippers the other night. You know who the two players who have had 38-14 so far this season are? SK's one, Anthony Davis is the other. That's pretty incredible for an undrafted dude.
For somebody who has spent like his first like 2 years in the D League.
Yeah, just couldn't be happier for him. Nobody deserves it more.
Definitely, and for once, we end the podcast on a positive note.
Look at that! We can do it! Yeah!